Let's turn in our Bibles tonight to the book of 1 Samuel. If you were reading your Jewish Bible, the Tanakh, and you had read through, studied through the book of Judges, of course, the last thing we read in the book of Judges is, in those days there was no king in Israel, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. The next thing you would read would be 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. Because you see, in the Tanakh, the Jewish Bible, the book of Ruth is located in another section, a section called the Writings. Now, there is a problem here with this verse. Judges, the last verse of Judges, Judges 21, 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. You know what the problem is with that statement? It is true. There was no human king in the nation of Israel. But listen, God was their king. The problem is they didn't want to be ruled by God. And so as you come through the book of Judges, particularly those closing chapters, we see chaos, we see moral anarchy. I mean, the country is a mess. And you can't help but notice the parallel in our own nation. There are competent people to rule and to lead. We have the mightiest military in the world, and yet, as a nation, we just can't seem to get things together. And what is the parallel? The parallel is the fact that we're excluding God from our nation. And I will tell you this, if you do that in your life personally, your life will be characterized by disorder, anarchy, moral chaos. We must let Jesus be king. Now, you're reading through your Jewish Bible, you come to this first verse of 1 Samuel. There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham. And you would probably read that and you would think, I bet that's the king. I bet that's the one that's going to become king of Israel. But you'd be wrong, of course. Elkanah, it's really not about him. It's about his wife. Actually, one of his wives. His first love wife. You see, what we will kind of figure out here is that Elkanah met Hannah. Maybe it was an arranged marriage, I don't know, but she was definitely his first love. Problem, she couldn't have kids. And in that culture, that was a big deal. It was a big deal for several reasons. First of all, what did God say in the very beginning? He said, be fruitful and multiply. And so the rabbis actually believed that if as a woman you were unable to do that, there was some kind of divine curse upon your life. And then, of course, Abraham, same thing. God said to Abraham, I am going to multiply your seed. They are going to be as the stars of the heaven, the sands of the sea. And, of course, it was incumbent upon all of the children of Abraham, so to speak, Abraham's descendants, to have kids. And then a very practical matter. Hey, this is an agrarian economy, and you need help out there plowing the fields, bringing in the harvest. So that's why you'd have a lot of kids, and you would hope that some of them would be able-bodied sons. So Elkanah, he did what other men had done. He married another wife. Her name, Peninnah. I read in one commentary that the word Peninnah means fruitful. However, I read in another commentary that her name meant something else, but he marries fruitful, and she has a lot of kids. But you see, whenever polygamy comes up in the Old Testament, especially, invariably, there is tension. It's trouble. And it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to understand why that might be. We see that over and over again. The friction, the often difficulty that the two wives would have getting along. So, reading here, Elkanah, by the way, it would appear, it says, Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. But he's not from the tribe of Ephraim. He's actually living in the mountains of Ephraim, but he is living in a Levitical city, and he's actually, and we see this in 1 Chronicles 6:27, he's actually a Levite. Well, he had two wives. I've told you a little bit about that. The name of one was Hannah, which means favored, and the name of the other, Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Down in verse 4, it says, Peninnah, his wife, had all her sons and daughters. She must have had a bunch of kids. And that made it tough on Hannah. But the toughest time of year, especially for Hannah, exclusively for Hannah, I should say, is when they went up to worship the Lord at Shiloh. Shiloh was where the tabernacle was. And everybody would go up there once a year. They would bring their sacrifices. And here, the picture seems to be of them, among other things, among other sacrifices, sharing together in the peace offering. I don't know if you remember, but the peace offering was an offering that everybody got to eat. You'd give the Lord his portion, and then the other portion of the sacrifice would be divided up amongst the family, and you would find this little picnic area, and you would be eating your portion, and you know, the Lord would have his, and it was a picture of fellowship, not just, you know, not just with the family, but fellowship with the Lord. You're all eating together. And we're told that Elkanah went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh, also the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord were there. Eli's the high priest, Hophni and Phinehas, his two sons, they were corrupt to the core. We'll see that later. But whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb. Bad enough that she couldn't have kids. Now, of course, today we would be trying to figure out the medical reason for her not being able to have children. But the bottom line was God had closed her womb. And I think her rival, fruitful, Peninnah, Ruby, whatever you want to call her, she sensed that this was kind of an opportunity to get back at Hannah, because she probably recognized, well, not probably, I know she recognized that Elkanah loved Hannah more than he loved Peninnah. And so when they would have these yearly getaways, you know, kind of like a family vacation, she would torment Hannah. It says in verse 6, and her rival also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb. There it is again. So it was year by year when she went up to the house of the Lord that she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved?" Now, I don't know why he would ask such a lame question that I'm about to read. "Am I not better to you than 10 sons?" That's not even the point. You know, she desperately desires to have a child. And they come on these trips, time for all of the kids. And of course, all of the kids were brought into the world by Peninnah. It's just time to have a good time. And yet, this Peninnah, you know, I don't know what she said. "Your name means favored, but God sure doesn't favor you. What do you have to worship about?" I don't know what kind of jabs and hurtful things that she said, but it was so severe that, you know, we see Hannah just not able to join in with the family. She's crying. She's not eating. So on this particular occasion, and this had been going on for years, and you can, I would hope you can just imagine the buildup of emotion and anguish and distress, and you know how you would come on these trips, and everybody's excited except you, and you just know that here it comes again. I'm going to get hammered by this banana. She's just not going to leave me alone. And what is this? This is the time when families come to worship Jehovah. You know, the core of this event is very much about worship. It's very much about reflecting on their heritage, on their spiritual heritage. It's very much about, you know, there's a somber time, of course, of making these sacrifices, but there's a time of rejoicing and a time of feasting. She can't enter into any of it because of the heaviness in her heart. And so you kind of see this thing all culminating in a tremendous sense of anguish and sorrow. It says, "So Hannah arose after they had finished eating and drinking in Shiloh. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat by the doorposts of the tabernacle of the Lord, and she was in bitterness of soul and prayed to the Lord and wept in anguish." I'm sure this is not the first time that Hannah had prayed about this situation. I'm sure this wasn't the first time she had said, "Lord, please, I just so desperately want a child." And the years are going by, and I just beg you, let me have a baby. And of course, here in this prayer, there's just a real anguish in her heart, a bitterness of soul. And she made a vow and said, "O Lord of hosts, Lord of all the angels, Lord of all the armies of Israel." There's no armies of Israel yet, but there will be. And this is an interesting address to the Lord. "O Lord of hosts." It's the first time it's used in the Bible. And Hannah's the one that uses this particular address for the Lord. "If you will indeed look on the affliction of your maidservant and remember me, and not forget your maidservant, but will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall come upon his head." You know what I see in my mind's eye? I just have to tell you this. Maybe I'm the only one. But when she prays that prayer, I can just imagine bells going off in heaven. There it is. There it is. Because, see, this is exactly what God wanted. In other words, God's will and Hannah's will have merged together. She's asked exactly what God is wanting. And I might say what God is waiting for Hannah to ask. I think we've all heard this. We all know this. But, you know, there's three possible answers when you pray. Yes, no, and wait. And this is the moment. Of course, this moment is no surprise to God. But Hannah, she's just come to the end of herself. You know, one thing that I just wanted to mention, you know, in all of this, just the irony of coming to a place where you're going to hopefully as a family worship the Lord and you're just so grieved. And I just, you know, it occurred to me today, maybe there's people, maybe even here tonight. You come to church. You come because this is where you need to be. But somehow, church reminds you of a shortcoming, a failure, and you look around and you see brothers and sisters sitting there and they're animated and they're blessed and their joy and their elation in the Lord, maybe it reminds you of something that you did, some failing in your life, and you feel like it was such a crucial mistake, and it just starts a process of disappointment in yourself, maybe even disappointment in God, and it just seems to go on and on. You don't have the joy. You don't have the desire to really enter in and feast on the Lord and you know, join in the fellowship with the brothers and sisters. You feel a little aloof. Well, that was certainly Hannah's position, and so she's come away, and she's just poured her heart out to the Lord. And she says, Lord, if you give me a male child, I'll give him back to you. And it was perfect. It was exactly what the... Now, she doesn't know this yet. In fact, it's interesting. She's praying in such a way, and this high priest, quite elderly, he's a big guy. You say, how do you know that? We'll find out later on the story. But you know, he's sitting there watching her, and because only her lips moved, the high priest Eli thought she was drunk. Eli, high priest, but apparently not a man of great spiritual sensitivity. So Eli said to her, how long will you be drunk? Put your wine away from you. But Hannah answered and said, no, my Lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief I have spoken until now. So she comes to this place. It becomes her altar there at the tabernacle. And she just pours it all out. All of the frustration, all of the hurt, all of the pain, all of the anguish, she just pours it out to the Lord. The high priest notices, misunderstands what's going on, but hearing her explanation, he says to her, verse 17, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition, which you have asked of him. And she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. And as you can probably imagine, in Hebrew, that would be a play on words. because what does her name mean? What does Hannah mean? Favor. It means favor. So let favor find favor in your sight. So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So a reversal has taken place here. She gets up from this prayer of pouring out anguish and pouring out sorrow and the bitterness of soul. And it's over. It's over. Her appetite comes back. The countenance of her face changes. Her face was no longer sad. Then they rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord and returned and came to their house at Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So it came to pass in the process of time that Hannah conceived and bore a son and called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked for him from the Lord. Now, a little explanation of what the name Samuel means. It literally means his name is God. But the core, the root word in Hebrew, the word, root syllable, I should say, was asked for. I mean, that you know, embedded in the word, his name is God, is the word asked for. So it gets a little wordy. So Samuel is the child who was asked for from the one who is God. Apparently, you know, Hannah wanted to memorialize that. You know, I asked for him from the Lord. And that becomes his name. So, she has this baby, and the man Elkanah and all the house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and his vow. But Hannah did not go, for she said to her husband, not until the child is weaned. Then I will take him, that he may appear before the Lord and remain there forever. So Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only let the Lord establish his word. Then the woman stayed and nursed her son until she had weaned him. You know, it's so interesting in reading the Bible and studying the Bible. And I've been doing that for many years now. You read a story and something jumps out at you. And I think in my mind, John, I've read this story many times, but what does that mean? What does what mean? Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only let the Lord establish his word. I thought about that, and I thought about that, and I studied that, and I looked around for that. Establish what word? Because where exactly did he mention something to her? I mean, where did he say something to her? I know Eli spoke to her, but where was the word? Well, you know, I've come to the conclusion with the help of several Bible scholars. I didn't figure this out on my own. But here's the deal. Somewhere along the line, Hannah realizes that there is going to be something very special about this baby that transcends all of the things that I told you about earlier, why it was important to have children, somehow it was communicated to her in her spirit that this baby is going to begin something that is huge in the plan of God. And the plan of God, essentially, I think the word that she's referring to is that God is going to make the descendants of Abraham a special people who will be a blessing to all nations. And there is going to be a reversal in the fortunes of the nation of Israel so that that process can begin in earnest. And you know, we start this book, and now I told you that, you know, their problem was they weren't allowing God to rule in their lives. There is no human king, but by the time we get to the end of 2 Samuel, there will be a king in place. And all of this is getting started now. And Hannah, she seems to have some insight that God is doing something special, and so does her husband Elkanah. I know we've got this little complication of polygamy in there, but Hannah and Elkanah were apparently a husband and wife that talked about the Lord's plan for the nation of Israel as best they understood it. They prayed together. They spent time before the Lord, and there was revelation of some things that pointed to them personally and pointed to this baby. This baby is going to be special. So the husband says, you know, you can stay here. Only let the Lord establish his word. You know, we need to take good care of this baby because it's going to be used. Then the woman stayed and nursed her son until she had weaned him. Typically, weaning would take place when the child turned 3 years old. Now, when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, and three bulls, one ephah of flour and a skin of wine, and brought him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, and the child was young. Then they slaughtered a bull and brought the child to Eli, and she said, O my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood by you here praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition which I asked of him. Therefore I also have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be lent to the Lord. Now, don't read this as meaning I'm letting the Lord borrow him. Okay, the expression, it actually echoes back to that same core word that is they're embedded in the name Samuel, and essentially what she is saying in the Hebrew, the sense of it, is what I have requested from the Lord, I am giving what I've requested back to the Lord. That isn't perfectly technically correct, but that's kind of the sense of it. And that's really, you know, what baby dedication is based on. We don't christen, we don't baptize babies here, but we do when a parent comes to us and says, I want to dedicate my child to the Lord. Listen, here it is right here. I want to give what God has given to me back to the Lord. I want to raise my child for the Lord Jesus Christ. Specifically, I want to raise my child for the purposes that God has intentioned for this boy, this girl. I want to dedicate him or her to the Lord. So, I don't know, this just has to be. Maybe some of you ladies in particular can identify with this, but do you see this picture? She so desperately wanted this child. And God graciously and in accordance with his plan, gave her that baby. And she nurses this child. And of course, in that, there's a very special relationship of bonding that takes place. This is a precious gift that God has given to her. But it's a gift of life. And in these initial years, she's watching the baby become an infant and then a toddler, and she's watching this wonderful development and growth that takes place in the personality beginning to emerge. And then she makes this journey to Shiloh, and this baby that she's prayed for, this baby that she's waited for years and years and years, probably wrapped in a blanket that she made, and she gives it to the high priest, and then she's going to go home, because that's going to be the home of this baby. She'll see him once a year, but it definitely won't be her baby anymore. Now, come on. Not just you sisters that would be in a situation like this, but maybe even dad too. I mean, we might want to go over and find some tree to sit under and just cry. Just have a good cry, you know. Our baby, we're leaving him here. And I'll tell you, I already gave you a little hint. Eli, Hophni, and what's the other guy's name? Hophni and Phinehas. That wouldn't be the most reassuring outfit to leave your precious child with. But she doesn't go over in a corner and cry. She prays. You say, why are you introducing this prayer like this? Because I want to drive something home that I think is really important. Notice how she begins the prayer. She says, my heart rejoices in the Lord. I've just relinquished this baby that was so precious to me that I waited for all of these years, something that I could have rejoiced in for the next 10 years of my life as I watched him grow up, but I've given him to the Lord, and he's not mine anymore. But who do I rejoice in? My heart rejoices in the Lord. I see that as very profound. I see that as something that talks back to me and says, John, what do you rejoice in? Really, what do you rejoice in? You know, and many of us here in this room, we've got plenty to rejoice in. But if the most precious possession that you rejoice in, perhaps flesh and blood, is taken away from you, are you able to pray what Hannah prayed? My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies. Now, notice it says, I smile. Doesn't say, I sneer. You know, a smile and a sneer can be very much alike. But no, she says, I smile. You know, what we see in this prayer, and this is an interesting prayer, if you have time later, compare this prayer with the prayer that Mary prays, you know, after she has been informed that she is going to be the mother of the Messiah. Compare her prayer with Hannah's prayer, because she obviously knows it. She pulls, this is Mary now, she pulls a lot of what Hannah prays, and David does too in his prayer at the end of 2 Samuel, but you see these tremendous parallels. And listen, here's what this prayer is all about. Here's what this prayer is all about. It's about tremendous reversals. You know, she at one time could say nothing to these jabs and these things that Peninnah would say to her. She was just beaten down. And now she says, my horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. Now, in the older editions, it says, my mouth is enlarged. It's like I have something to say now. I can open my mouth now. The word horn is exalted. I mean, what does that mean? Well, it actually, you know, again, in that culture, animals were familiar to them, and many animals had horns. You know what I'm talking about, those kind of things, or maybe one great big horn. And the bigger the horn, the more powerful the animal, because it was equipped with this horn. And, you know, where once I was weak, I was beaten down mercilessly by the words of this woman, now there is a power, and it comes from the Lord. My power is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. Now, I have a hunch. I have a hunch when she talks about her salvation. And you know, Mary says the same thing in her prayer. But I think Hannah is thinking beyond just her own personal salvation. I believe that Hannah now has this vision for her country that, you know, God's on the move, and the mess that the nation of Israel finds itself in every way, spiritually, morally, governmentally, God is going to come and he's going to bring salvation. And she says, I rejoice in your salvation. And Lord, I'll tell you something else. No one is holy like you. Actually, she says, no one is holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you, nor is there any rock like our God. Now, in the Old Testament, rock was often a word that was used to represent God, because there were these rocks out in the plains, out in the desert, and they were so deeply buried into the sand that they were totally immovable. You couldn't move that rock. You couldn't budge that rock. If you tied 1,000 horses, if you harnessed 1,000 horses to that rock, you couldn't do anything, because that rock was solid. And so they would often liken God to a rock. You're my rock. You are immovable. Talk no more so very proudly. Let no arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is the God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. Do you not see that as a warning? Now, of course, this is a veiled reference to Peninnah, who spoke proudly and arrogantly. I have all these kids. I'm very fruitful, you know, and you have nothing. But God heard that. And it would have been better if Peninnah had not said anything, because now her words are coming back to embarrass her. You ever had that happen before? You ever thought, why didn't I just keep my mouth shut? Why did I have to say anything? The bows of the mighty men are broken, and those who stumbled are girded with strength. So this key word that characterizes this prayer, you know, where God has just turned things around. God has reversed a situation. Here's all of these Philistines, and they've got these weapons, and they've got these bows and arrows, and they're powerful. And you know what? There's coming someone who's going to be able to defeat the Philistines. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, and the hungry have ceased to hunger. Even the barren has borne 7, and she who has many children has become feeble. And by the way, this isn't the only child that Hannah will have. she's going to have more. The Lord kills and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and he brings up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and lifts up. He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the beggar from the ash heap to set them among princes and make them inherit the throne of glory. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he has set the world upon them. He will guard the feet of his saints, but the wicked shall be silent in darkness. For by strength no man shall prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken in pieces. You see the flow of this, right? You see what she envisions. And what she sees is what we should see. You know, there are times when it looks so hopeless. We look around the world today and we think, oh my goodness, it seems like the enemies, the adversaries of God are winning. No, God will win. You see, God can turn these things. God can make a reversal instantly. And these people, these people that act like they're going to live forever, God can put them down. And those who are weak and infirm, in whatever way you want to characterize it, God can raise them up. God can give life to their mortal soul. These tremendous contrasts. You think you're strong? You think you're going to prevail because of your natural strength? For by strength no man shall prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken in pieces. From heaven he will thunder against them. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the horn of his anointed. Boy, this Hannah, she's a little prophet, isn't she? Now, just a few concluding thoughts here. You look at the nation of Israel, and all along the way, there were Hannahs, so to speak, meaning there were women who were barren. I'm sure a lot of people laughed at Abraham and his wife. You know, Abraham, father of many nations. That's what his name literally meant. And he didn't have any kids at all. And so as we've read the story, listen, this book, it is the story of salvation. And as we read through this story, we see these places where, you know, they can't have any kids. It's all coming to a halt. And you know, how does God cap the whole thing off? A virgin conceives. A virgin gives birth to the Savior. And there's people to this day, this is that just can't happen. That's just that is medically impossible. I can't believe that. But you see, we're talking about God. We're talking about a God who has a mighty plan of salvation in place, and how exciting it is to just move through the Word of God and see chapter after chapter concerning this salvation that He has. But you that can identify a bit with Hannah, you're just not able to enter in the way you'd like to enter in, and you're not able to enjoy what God would have for you to enjoy. Listen, the key. There's several keys, but the big key is we have to come to that place where you absolutely humble yourself before the Lord. That is the theme. We see this theme in the Old Testament, in the New Testament. Humble yourself in the eyes of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. And one of the ways that we humble ourselves is just to pour out that anguish and pour out that bitterness of soul and give it to the Lord. We have to do that. That's part of the process. And you say, well, I can't imagine humbling myself so low in that kind of way. I just don't see it. Well, then you see the Lord. You see the Lord. He humbled himself lower than you'll ever get. How low? Well, you know, Paul gives it to us in Philippians chapter 2. You know, made himself of no reputation. Said, it's all right. I can lay aside this glory. I don't have to be known as the Prince of Heaven. I don't have to be known as the Son of God. I can just lay all of that aside. And I will come and I won't just be some normal guy. I'll be a bondservant. I'll be a slave. But not only that, he was obedient to the point of death. And when he died, what did he do? He took all of our collective sin upon himself. So, you wonder, how do I humble myself like that? Well, Jesus did it. And is he high and lifted up? Boy, there's coming a day when all of creation, it will reverberate from one end to the other, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So tonight, let it go. The anguish, the bitterness, just give it to the Lord that he might birth something new, something glorious in your life. Now, this is not just a story of pouring out. This is a story of incredible sacrifice. You know, we see woven into the story, worship. And certainly Hannah worshiped, but she gave up that which was most precious to her. She gave it to the Lord. And sacrifice, that's a big key as well. Letting go of things that we so desperately want to hold on to, but we're just bearing witness in our heart that this is something that I just have to place at the altar of God, or I have to put into the hands of the Lord and walk away and know that God is going to be faithful with the sacrifice that I've made. And then the third thing, Hannah, she pours out her heart before the Lord, goes home, gets pregnant, has this baby, spends 3 years with it, brings it to the priest, gives it to the priest, and having made that sacrifice, instead of looking to herself, she just focuses on the Lord, says, Lord, I rejoice in you. And God just gives her this incredible insight as to what he's going to do. And, you know, we can look in one of two directions. We can look back and be sad at the mistakes and the failures and the things that have put us where we are, or we can rid ourselves of all of that and look to the Lord and say, Lord, here I am. What do you want to do? And I will tell you, God will begin to reveal fresh vision in your life. How specific? I don't know. But he'll do a new work. He'll birth something new in you. That's the story of Hannah. And you know, the story of Hannah, it reverberates all through the Bible. Now, Father, I come before you tonight, and I do believe that as we would look to you, that, Lord, you would show us things that we need to let go of. things that just need to be poured out of our life and down the drain, Lord, down into that place where those things are completely covered over by the blood of Jesus Christ. And Lord, I pray that we would be careful and that we would be faithful to listen to you tonight and not leave here in bitterness of soul, but leave here rejoicing in you, rejoicing in your goodness. Leave here willing to make that supreme sacrifice, whatever that might be. Maybe we're not sure right now, but we need to have that mindset that says, Lord, I am so secure in my identity in you and what you have for me that whatever it is that I need to relinquish, whatever it is that I need to sacrifice to you, I'm willing to do that. I want to do that. I look forward to what you might have for me.